Hello, and thank you for listening to episode 18 of 60 Minutes With. I'm Dave, and in this episode, I'm joined by my first returning guest. He joined me on episode 1, where we concentrated on all of the work that he'd done, and we did touch on this subject. And when we did touch on it, we did say that we would get him back onto the show and have a full show dedicated to it. That subject is the movie Detroit Rock City, and he's the writer of that. It's good timing, actually, because the new Blu-ray release of Detroit Rock City has not long since come out, so we thought it'd be perfect timing to get this show out to all the KISS fans and movie fans that are out there. There's a little bit of audio, not problems, but you will hear Carl's computer fan, which seems to be quite vigorously firing itself up now again as we're recording. But it by no means distracts from all the great stories that you're going to hear. We did chat about when we finished recording. Carl told me that about 90% of the stuff we chatted about, he's never talked about before, so you're getting all new information here. You'll find things out, I'll tease you now before we get into the actual conversation with him. You'll find things out, I'll say medieval KISS. That will make more sense when you've listened. Mr. Microphone. You'll also find out, I put him on the spot and say about what would happen with Jam and Trip and Hawk and Lex. If there was a Detroit Rock City sequel set now, what would those characters think of KISS now? And what sort of storylines would happen? And we go off on a good tangent with that. And even though Carl was put on the spot, he comes up with some good storylines for the characters already. So, yeah, I will push him to write Detroit Rock City too, because I personally would like to see it, if nothing else. So anyway, enough of me chatting on. Just sit back, relax, get comfortable, and spend, I was going to say, the 60 minutes, but it's more than 60 minutes. There was so much information to get in. I think it's going to be about a 90-minute show. But either way, get ready, prepare yourselves. You're in for a treat as I have another chat with Carl Dupree. So, Carl, thank you once again for joining me. It seems, well, when was it? It was way back in September, wasn't it, when you joined me on episode 1 of 60 Minutes With.
I know. I've been waiting here. It's been a while. It's been like 6 months. But I have my sleeping bag here, you know. I got my snack and whatnot to keep me through. No, it was good, and I really enjoyed it. It was a very good interview, you know, and I'm just going to briefly tip my hat to you as someone who you are a good interviewer. You know what questions to ask to get, well, at least for me, to get the jog my memory and get the stories going. And it was a pleasure. Good talking to you, and looking forward to this one.
Well, thank you. That's very kind of you to say so. Thank you very much. Well, we did. We teased on that one, didn't we? We did promise that you would be back and would dedicate an episode to Detroit Rock City. And what better time to do it? I mean, because the Blu-ray has just been released, and before we started recording, you said you'd had your Blu-ray delivered. Was it yesterday?
Yes, it was. Yep, I just got it from Amazon yesterday. Shout out to Amazon, I guess. I don't know. Can we say brand names here? Yeah. I don't know. Whatever.
Yes. Yeah. Why not?
And if you Amazon Prime, day shipping. I don't know. Whatever. I'm not. And I'm not getting any money from Amazon for this. I just want people to know. But it's pretty cool. It was pretty cool. I got the disc yesterday, and I checked it out. The only thing is, I was kind of hoping they'd come with a little booklet in it. You know how sometimes they come with booklets?
Yeah.
Mine did not come with a booklet, although it came with something that looked like it was supposed to hold a booklet. So, I don't know. You know, that's, I guess, caveat emptor, you know, on that one. Let the buyer beware. But I don't know what they put in the booklet that hasn't already been said anyway, you know what I mean? But very, very stoked to check it all out and to see, you know, see like that Blu-ray, the difference in the picture. That's the main thing. That I'm not so much an extras type person, although I did check out some of the extras on this one. But I really dug how the picture is just incredible, crisp, sharp, you know. I'm a big fan of, I don't know, I'm going to date myself a lot here. I remember, seeing these movies when I was a kid. There were these movies. One of them was Modern Problems with, Chevy Chase, mm-hmm. Which is not exactly the greatest movie ever made. And then the other one was The other one was The Incredible Shrinking Woman with Lily Tomlin. And the reason why I'm saying that, I mean, these aren't, of course, benchmark, you know, incredible. Like, they didn't sweep the Academy Awards, and they didn't, like, climb to the top of any box office charts or, you know, whatever critics charge, top 10 list. But there was a certain type of cinematography from that period of time, and those are the movies that I can think of off the top of my head, where the colors are very vivid, and they were almost like neon. It was almost like a neon look. And when I was watching this Blu-ray last night, that's what it struck me. I was like, wow, it really captures the time. Like, I don't know, it looks like a movie from 1978. In terms of cinematography, yeah. You know, in terms of colors and you know, photography, and that's the reason why I'm bringing that stuff up. I was very, you know, it was really cool. It's really cool to see the what the picture looked like.
Yeah, Blu-ray, so, I'm still waiting for mine to be delivered. Mine's I've had the postage notification, but it hasn't arrived yet. So I'm still relying. I've got the new line platinum release on DVD, which I believe has still got all the same extras as the new Blu-ray. But of course, you're going to get, you know, the upgrade hopefully in the picture too. So I'm looking forward to that dropping through the post box.
Nice, yeah. Well, it's worth it. It's good. It's worth the wait, I would say.
No, that's good to hear. Then that's good to hear. Well, I think my first question for you then, let's start this off with, how and when did you become a Kiss fan?
All right. Yes, that's great. That's a good question. My first recollection of becoming a Kiss fan. Like, I had heard about Kiss in the sort of ether. I was 12 or 13 at the time, and it was in the air. Kiss was something in the air. It was something people were talking about. I don't know if I told you this in the last interview, but I was kind of addicted to Rolling Stone magazine. I had to be there. I had to read every month. I had to read my Rolling Stone magazine and my Mad magazine. Those were my two magazines that I had to read. And I remember starting to read about Kiss, and, you know, there was an article in one of the Rolling Stones where I was like, oh, this looks really weird, like that, you know, the kabuki makeup and whatnot. But it didn't really sink in until I took a chance. I was like, somebody at school was talking about Kiss Alive 2. And I'm like, this is the greatest album. You can't believe, like, this is just awesome. It's the best thing ever. It's even better than Kiss Alive 1. And I didn't even know what Kiss Alive 1 was at the time. But I dragged my mom, of course, to the record store, and we had to buy Kiss Alive 2. And I just, it was one of those things, like, you know, it's such a kid thing to do. You know, I got the record. I was like, come on, let's get home, hurry up. Like, telling my mom to step on it, go home. So I could run up to the record player and put it on and just listen to it, you know, put the headphones on, listen to it straight through without a break. You know what I mean? It's such a, like, I don't know. That was me. That was like the type of stuff that I do. An idea would take hold of me, and sure enough, like, I think I was initially doing this to be cool, like to be with the other kids, and like they were all talking about this. So, oh, maybe I should be doing this now because it's a cool thing to do. You know, I'm the type of kid, like, I probably would have jumped off a bridge if everybody else jumped off a bridge. I might have done that. I don't know, but it worked out well in this instance. That, you know, I really got, I saw something, like, a lot of these songs, they weren't, I knew, like, the hit songs from Kiss, but, like, there was a lot of stuff on this album, on Kiss Alive 2, that I didn't hear on the radio, and it opened this door in my brain. It was like, there's more stuff than just what's on the radio, and you know, in general, you know, like there are other things that are going on, and you don't have to just listen to the radio. You don't have to be mainstream, and you can listen to other things. And I just loved all the feeling I got when I listened to that. I was like I said, I had headphones, and I was like, boy, I really felt like I was in that crowd. Yeah. I felt like I was. But it wasn't enough because all I could do was use my imagination. I was like, I've got to see these guys. I've got to see this, you know. And then I started paying attention when people were talking about, you know, the antics, the circus atmosphere, and just like this, you know, explosions and just things catching fire, Gene Simmons spitting blood, and Ace's guitar smoking and Chris's drum set rising in the air, and I was like, I gotta see this. And that was like my next, that was after I got that album, I needed to do that. I needed to, and you know, it was very well timed, of course, because if you remember, Kiss Alive 2 came out during the Kiss Alive 2 tour. So conveniently enough, I don't know if that was a coincidence, but anyway, the Kiss Alive 2 tour was happening, so I had to see, and I saw them in Providence. And but anyway, it was a pretty like I can pinpoint like pretty much when Kiss Alive 2 came out. That was when I became a Kiss fan. So there's a short answer to that question. When Kiss Alive 2 came out, I became a Kiss fan.
That was good because on the way home as well, while you were waiting to listen to it, you'd got that amazing Inner Sleeve from the Gatefold album to look at as well. You know, that incredible photograph. Oh my.
It was amazing stuff. Yeah. Oh, it was incredible. I loved all that. I loved it. And it was like that's the beauty of Kiss, especially at that time, is that, you know, they delivered for the fans. They really did. They're like, they gave us what we wanted. They really did. You know, when you buy that, you weren't just buying it as a double album, which is awesome. You know, I know that a lot of people out there probably, you know, yeah, double album. People are getting back into vinyl, but that was cool. And there's a double album. Oh, it's a double album. So open it up, and there's this album, and that album. There was a great. There was a great program inside there. The pictures are just phenomenal. The pictures are just amazing. You know, when you're listening to that, you're looking at the pictures, and you like feel like, oh man, you listen to that crowd cheering, you know, and pardon me, you listen to that crowd cheering, and you're looking at the pictures, and it's almost like you're there, but it really is in actuality. It is like the biggest tease in the world. You know, you could see them putting together this whole package, Kiss and you know, Gene Simmons and Paul, you know, the management, everybody getting together and going, all right, what we want to do is we want to give people like the biggest tease they could possibly get, that will make them want to run out and buy tickets to see us.
Yeah,
you know, it was almost like, well, you got a gift for the people who already saw them, and it was a tease for the people who didn't. So it was really cool. It was really awesome.
So as we go down your timeline then, how did the initial sort of genesis of the Detroit Rock City story begin with you? What kicked that off? Did you start making notes at any particular time? Did the idea of a Kiss movie come to you, or did certain characters come to you? How was the whole beginning of it, basically?
Oh, okay, yeah. Well, there was this kid who I worked with. This is back in the late 80s, and I worked we had this restaurant job. I was a cook, he was a waiter. But anyway, we were exchanging stories about, like, concert experiences, I guess. Like, I can't remember how we stumbled upon this, but this kid just started talking about, you know, yeah, I saw The Who a couple of years ago because, you know, me and my friends were driving around, and we knew that The Who was playing at, like, at the time it was Foxborough Stadium. I guess it's Gillette Stadium now in Foxborough, Massachusetts. But he said the way that they got in was, this one kid goes, I know how we can do it. Let's, you know, I got a plan. And, of course, that plan was he wanted, you know, this guy I worked with, to punch him in the face, basically. And then he's like, you know, punch me, just give it to me nice and hard, just like punch me as hard as you can. So he did, and the kid's like got like a black eye popping out, he's got the blood coming out of the mouth. He's like, come on, let's go. And they ran up to the ticket takers, and they said, somebody just mugged us and took all our tickets. And then they got into the show, and I filed that. Isn't that funny? Like, I filed that. It was a Who concert, true, it wasn't even a Kiss concert, but I filed that away. I said, that would be really good in a movie. You know, it was like one of those like things just sat there in my head. I put it into a shoebox. You know, it was like a shoebox of like concert stories. And I mean, there are crazy things that happened. Too many crazy things for me to even like. That would be a whole nother movie. I said that to those guys at the time, if they ever wanted to make a Detroit Rock City sequel, like, we were thinking, like, depending on the success of this one, you could just jump into it and make a sequel. I said, well, the second one would probably take place during the concert, and all these ridiculous things happen at the concert. Because that's where most of my... There have been, like, crazy things that just happen at concerts, and all the concerts that I've been to... There was just crazy stuff going on all over the place, in and around the concerts, and that was almost like a whole different story there. But I latched on to that one, the and I said that would be like, I mean, that would be really cool in a movie. And so it just sat there in my head for a few years, and then I'm working on this. I told you I was an assistant editor, and I was working on this movie called Skinner with editor Peter Schenck, who wound up cutting Detroit Rock City. And we'd just be talking about Kiss. He would bring in, like, Kiss action figures to put, like, in with the editing equipment. You know, he'd, like, tape them onto the top of his, the monitor of his, at the time he was cutting on a Chem, which everything is digital now, but that was, where you actually physically cut the film. I mean, he had, like, the members of Kiss sitting up there. He also had, like, Star Trek action figures and all this other stuff. But I noticed the Kiss ones, and we just started talking about Kiss. And we just, just started, like, exchanging, stories about, and every Kiss fan, he was my age, so... We'd talk about, like, how devastating it was when they came out with a disco song, like that moment when Dynasty came out. Like, oh, no, really? Come on. They can't do this. And, just these little chapters in history, I guess you could say. And he told me he, like, had all these stories about, like, he was up on... all the Kiss trivia, all the Kiss lore, and, like, I consider myself, I'm a pretty universal, or how can I put it, like, I liked rock and roll as a whole, back then especially. Like, it all congealed into one thing for me, and I did like The Who, and I did like Led Zeppelin and all those other things, Pink Floyd, but Kiss really sort of opened the door to all that for me, and that was my, like, my connection with Kiss is definitely like, it's a time and a place for me. It's a place in my childhood. The intro to rock music. Pete Schenck, boy, he followed Kiss intensely throughout the 80s, which was it was more than I could do. I think once they started they took the makeup off and they started changing people out, I already started getting a resentment against them. Like, I want the old kids. I'm like, one of these guys, I'm like, I want the old Star Wars movie. I don't care about all this other stuff. I want the first Star Wars movie. I know it's called Episode 4 and whatever, but I call it Star Wars, damn it. That's my whole thing. He talked about how, Gene Simmons, yeah, he supposedly got the piece of skin under his tongue cut out and all that, so his tongue would be longer, and like stuff like that, like all these all this trivia. And one day, like, I saw I Want to Hold Your Hand, which I think is a brilliant, absolutely brilliant comedy. I like the comedies, like the old, like, Marx Brothers movies. I like the Billy Wilder comedies, something like It Hot. Like, I like those movies, like the comedies from the 40s and 50s. And I guess maybe a little bit of the 60s, but, like, the ones that are really tightly written, and every line of dialogue is pretty much a gem. I thought I Want to Hold Your Hand was, like, a great, like, that was a great comedy. And, Robert Zemeckis and Bob Gale, they made some really incredible movies. But, I mean, that's, like, to me, for them, like, that, oh, well, Back to the Future, of course, that's the jewel in their crown, shall we say. But I Want to Hold Your Hand, great story, great, like, and I loved how, like, it had all these characters, you saw them at the beginning of the movie all together, and then it split them up, and you, and yeah. you find, I don't know if you've ever seen it, but there are all these characters, and you know the crux of the movie, there's they're going to see the Beatles perform at the Ed Sullivan Show, and so they're all together, and it's a few girls and a few boys, and they sort of their paths disperse, and they go on these little adventures, each one of them, and they all have like a rite of passage. So I said to Pete one day, I was like, oh, somebody should make I Want to Hold Your Hand, but with Kiss as the Holy Grail. And he goes, oh yeah, because I want to see that. He goes, I want to see that script on my desk on Monday. That was like a joke we had. I want to see that on my desk on Monday. You know what I mean? We had an idea. I want to see that script on my desk on Monday. I'm like, I was like, aha, you know, I was thinking, oh yeah, that's pretty funny. But like, I kept like ruminating on that. I was like, it would be nice to see that. And then, don't you know, like I go to work on Monday and he goes, hey, where's that Kiss script? I said, yeah, it's pretty funny. So every couple of weeks or so, he'd be like, hey, you work on that Kiss script? And I'd be like, you know, I do have, and I did, seriously, I'd have ideas here and there. I'd be like, hey, wouldn't it be funny if like this, I had a scene where the kids get pulled over. Well, actually they get the tire blows out on their car and they get a female tow truck driver who comes, and she's like this sort of big, like Large Marge from Pee-wee's Big Adventure. Large Marge, you know, it's big, tow truck driver. And they've just been listening. They had a CB radio in the car, which that totally got written out of the script. But the four kids, they have a CB radio in the car, and they just hear this stuff about, people talking about beavers, you know, and this beaver this, beaver that, which, of course, is a derogatory term for woman. So this tow truck driver comes up, and they're like, hey, beaver, could you help us out? You know what I mean? They automatically just call her a beaver, you know, and I'm pitching this idea to people. It's like, oh, yeah, you got to write that in there. So I'm like, all right, I'm going to do that. And I had these little like notes to myself, like female tow truck driver scene, you know, like that would be like a card that I've had have, and but nothing, like I'm pretty good at procrastinating, or I was, at least at that time. I was really good at like, how can I put it? There are different like things that writers do to like they want to think like they're doing something, but they're actually procrastinating. So it's like, oh, I think I'm going to wait until I have all the scenes written down on these pieces of paper before I actually start writing the script. Heaven forbid you start writing the script. But anyway, it was nothing really came of it. And I finally I worked on the next movie I worked on. Like there was about a 3 or 6 month break. And then I wound up on another movie with Pete. And it was directed by a guy named James Malconian. And the name of the movie was The Stoned Age, which took place in the 70s. And, like, the band in that was Blue Oyster Cult. We never saw them perform live. It wasn't, you know, part of the story. But it was about Blue Oyster Cult fans, basically. And we were, and the soundtrack was awesome. And it was really hilarious. And it's a funny movie. It's, if you ever get a chance to check it out, it's another one of like those movies from the 70s. Movies, you know, so we're working on this movie, and after that gets wrapped, after the movie wraps, meaning like, you know, we're they get ready to release it, we're all done. I wind up having lunch with Pete and James Malconian, and then Pete goes, hey, you know, Carl's been working on this Kiss script, and I'm like, oh yeah, the Kiss script. I'm doing that twice. I'm like, and I'm not sure how much time has gone by now. I think it's probably about 6 months or so since, you know, the last I talked about it with Pete, and he goes, oh, he goes, how long you been working on that, James Malcone? How long you been working on that? I go, oh, about 6 months. He goes, oh, you must be almost done then, huh? And I'm like, yeah, I'm almost done. You know, probably another couple of months. Like that, more like, you know, 6 weeks. It's like, he's like, oh yeah, 6 weeks. I'm like, oh my god, I just put this like deadline on this casual lunch. I just started, you know, we were like eating whatever, and then by the end of that lunch I suddenly had a 6 week deadline to write an entire screenplay. I think it was either 6 weeks or 2 months, I can't remember. I was like, oh my God, what am I going to do? Well, the first thing I did was I just started reading scripts like what I wanted, like I Want to Hold Your Hand. And, you know, I watching movies about, you know, there's never really, I guess, Rock and Roll High School, you know, but just digesting these movies and reading the screenplays, but going at it like I was cramming for a final exam and doing that for like weeks and weeks and weeks on end. And I started writing a draft of Detroit Rock City, which I was really inspired by Pulp Fiction. I think maybe I told you this before, but I was very, very inspired by that for a little. The dialogue in Detroit Rock City, the first draft, has these long stretches of dialogue, and I was really I liked Quentin Tarantino's ability to just sit with characters and let them talk, and it's almost like, you know, there's an enjoyment in that, you know, the art of conversation. It's kind of like Seinfeld, you know. It's not about nothing. It's about how people interact, and I really enjoyed that. So, but I just got like I got done seeing Pulp Fiction, and I'm like, oh man. And I guess I didn't get done. Maybe I rented it because we're talking. It's like a year later or 2 years later. But I'm like, well, maybe I can do something with that. Maybe there's like this disjointed timeline that I could create. And what I did was, I had these four kids at the beginning of the movie being together, and they're actually, when the movie starts, they're in line to see Star Wars. Isn't that weird? They're in line to see Star Wars, which I may have played with time a little bit, but I think Star Wars, if I remember correctly, it was a hit for a long time. People kept lining up for months and months and months. But anyway, they, it starts out at a line to see Star Wars, and then somebody winds up getting tickets to the Kiss concert, and it took place in Rhode Island. Okay, it starts out, it takes place in Rhode Island. They're at the Showcase Cinema. They're gonna go see Star Wars. They're in the line. Somebody gets four tickets to see Kiss at the Tonight's Show at the Providence Civic Center, which they really wanted to see. And they're like bumming out. They're going to see Star Wars because they can't go see Kiss. Basically, they're like bummed. You know what I mean? They got screwed out of seeing Kiss. So then the four of them go and they split off. And then what you do is you have Hawk's entire story from beginning to end. And every once in a while he interacts with the other characters, but you have like a half hour of Hawk. Then you go back to the line again, and you have a half hour of Trip. Then a back, you know what I mean? Then, yeah. And each time it ends at the moment before they beat the, it like ends at that all is lost moment for each of them. And then once Lex's story is done, you know, he comes like the, each story ends with that like moment where they're like, you know, in the movie, you know, they come to the four, that intersection. Like that's where each story ends. And then, you know, basically, Andy, they get back together, and then they beat the hell out of each other, and they go see the concert. Then it worked out for about 30 pages, this draft of the disjointed timeline of Detroit Rock City, and then it was getting a little too messy, and I think I was I was probably getting too clever for my own good. You know what I mean? So I said, maybe this deserves a more straightforward presentation. I went back and I said, all right, the movie starts in Providence, but I want like a road trip in here. I knew I wanted a road trip somewhere in there. And that was the other thing was, you know, I wanted that. I wanted that experience of them. You know, I wanted the Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid experience of like riding across the wilderness. You know what I mean? And going the distance. You know, like that's something in literature, in lore. You know, a character has to make a journey. You know what I mean? Ever since you freaking, you know, the Odyssey. You know what I mean? A character has to prove, that they really want something, and that is a great way to show it, to actually show it in a movie, to show them going any distance at all. So it's okay, these guys are committed to doing this. They really are, you know. They really want this badly. And so the original script, well, I guess you could say that at this point, the second draft started in Providence and then in New York City. They were going to go see Kiss in New York. And I was recently telling somebody about this. They were asking me why I started it in Cleveland. I decided this movie's going to be called Detroit Rock City. I said, well, it's one of those reverse engineering things. Roger Corman said, you come up with a poster, then you come up with a title, then you come up with a story. You know, but I'm not cheating. I said this movie has to be called Detroit Rock City, just like, and it has to happen at Cobo Hall. And Cobo Hall is where it's a legendary location in Kiss-tory. It's just there's something about it. You gotta if you're gonna make a movie about Kiss, I said, well, if I'm gonna make a movie about a bunch of people seeing a Kiss concert, it has to be at Cobo Hall. How could it not be at Cobo Hall? You know, so okay, Cobo Hall, boom, Detroit Rock City, there it is. And I had to pick a place on the map that was, you know, about a 3 to 6 hours drive. I wanted them to really have to go a ways to see this concert. You know, it couldn't be like hop, skip, and a jump. But I mean, you know, it's just something, you know, something challenging. So that's how that wound up happening.
It's all right. I was feeding back on myself, and I was getting all sorts of echo. You mentioned about the CB radio idea that you were writing in to it that was eventually cut out. What sort of other parts can you tell the listeners about that was in the original script that wasn't filmed?
Yeah, off the top of my head, there was a scene where they all go to a pizza place. They picked up the pizza to go to bust jam out. You know what I mean? They were in the movie. They intercept a pizza man, the pizza pig guy. In the first draft, they actually go to a pizza place to put the shrooms on the pizza to give to the priest. And they go to this pizza place, and there's a TV. above the counter where they order the pizza, and the first commercial, and you just see these two commercials. The first one has Rula Lenska in it. I don't know if you remember Rula Lenska.
I certainly do. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so she is Rula Lenska, and then the next one was the Nair commercial, which when I was a kid, I don't know if you had if you were aware of this, but they had these who wears short shorts commercials. For this product called Nair, which is it's for people who don't want hair on their bodies, most specifically women, and who want to wear really short shorts. So they had this short commercial based on that 50s song. You know, it went, "Who wears short shorts? We wear," and it's these women, and it's like it was practically like an R-rated commercial. I don't know how it was like it just close-ups on these women wearing very short shorts. And this like the kids just have a break in like they're about to order the pizza and they're just staring at this short shorts commercial and you can tell that they're sort of entranced by these butts dancing around on the TV screen. But I was like, oh yeah, we got to use like the original commercials. That would be just so cool to have those in there, just like trip down memory lane. And then the other thing was there was this product called Mr. Microphone. Do you remember that?
No, I don't remember that one.
Mr. Microphone was a microphone that you could turn your radio on. You could talk through your radio, or you could talk through a radio anywhere. So you have this microphone. You can turn your stereo on, and suddenly you're like the MC at a party. Like your voice is booming through the speakers and your hi-fi, you know, and the commercial had them like had people just talking into this microphone and their voices are coming out of all these different audio devices. And then there's this guy driving around in a car and he's got the radio up loud and he's talking in this Mr. Microphone and he's yelling. He's like, "Hey, good looking. We'll be back to pick you up later." Right. And, you know, there are these girls walking down the street and this guy's like, "You got this Mr. Microphone." So that was the thing that Jam was going to use at the end instead of using sort of bull.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Use this Mr. Microphone. He was gonna get up and turn this Mr. Microphone on and use that to yell at his mom. So then those are all things from that era, you know, that I wanted to put in there. It was a long list of things. It was very interesting. When I was writing it, I would be in a room full of people at certain points and I'd go, "Hey, what do you remember about 1978? I just do that. What do you remember about 1978? And then like I'd be like sitting there, I'd be jotting things down. And it was pretty funny. It was pretty cool, you know. You never know when you can have like a spontaneous brainstorm session. If you're writing a script and you're having writer's block because you're not sure what would happen, or you know if you want to create an atmosphere like that, like if you're doing a period story, you can just like stop every, if you're in a room full of people, just stop for saying, "Hey, what do you remember about this? What do you know about that?" And see what kind of answers you get, because that's writing can be a community effort sometimes, in that sense.
Yeah, so you got this 6-week block thing, this sort of self-imposed deadline that you talked yourself into at this point. What I mean, obviously, this was a pretty intense 6 weeks then.
So. Oh my God, it was. I was sweating bullets, but once I arrived at that structure, I guess you could say, and I'd read so many scripts. I read Sid Field. I read Adventures in the Screen Trade by William Goldman, which is a really great book if you want to learn how to write scripts. It's really, really good. That shined a light on the process for me. And there were scripts that I read, and I'm trying to pick these scripts apart. What do I like? What do I don't like? And like trying to force. They say, you know, in the screenwriting trade, story's supposed to have three acts, and this is supposed to happen between page 1 and page 30, and this is supposed to happen between page 30 and page 60, and, you know, there are these plot twists that are supposed to happen, and unfortunately, I think all that's done is it's made movies kind of predictable today. Hate to say it, but if you see an original movie, there's definitely a structure going on, but it's not always like, sometimes, you know, when people rebel against that structure, it winds up working really well. But anyway, to make a long story short, I had this like moment. It was like a Zen thing. I just said, "I'm just going to write a story with a beginning, a middle, and an end." You know, that's what I'm going. This is the first act, the beginning. The second act is the middle. You have title cards. The middle. Wouldn't you like the Monty Python? Welcome to the middle of the film. The middle. And then the end, you know, and I said, all right, maybe I'm taking a risk here because I keep the characters together for a long time. And then all of a sudden I disperse them, like in the middle of the story. But it happens right after that moment where they lose, they find out they don't have tickets. They went all the way up to Detroit and they have no tickets and the car gets stolen. They're all out of money. You know, it's like things can't get any worse. And then that's when they split up. And I thought, well, if the audience really likes these characters, they're going to be like, oh my God, you know, these guys got to get back together somehow. But they're really going to be on board with this, each character going through their rite of passage and, you know, becoming men. These are boys becoming men, you know, kids becoming grown-ups. And this is their last, like, it's the last sort of this is the moment that you have when you're not quite a kid anymore and you're not a grown up yet, you know what I mean? That like this moment where the four of them are still together, and yeah, they've got their, you know, they've got the rest of their lives to look at, but this is like you know, just like this memory that they'll have, they're independent now and they can do what they want to do. And what do they want to do? They want to go see a Kiss concert, of course. You know, it's like, you know.
Who wouldn't want to go to a Kiss concert?
Yeah. Well, And I, like I said, they're still kids at heart. So I don't know, you know, at that point, at least at that point in the story.
Hey, that's, I mean, come on, I'm 50 this year and I still can't wait for the next Kiss concert that I'm going to. So you know, it's still relevant to me even now.
Well, happy birthday. I'm going to be 50 in June myself. So.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm a month later. So.
The half century club.
That's it. Me and you together.
Yeah. But that's great. Where are you seeing Kiss?
Well, they play in Donington. They're booked in to do the big Monsters of Rock festival here. Well, it used to be called Monsters of Rock. It's called now. But I've still got my fingers crossed that they do an arena tour. I much prefer to see them in arenas. So hopefully that's going to happen.
Yeah. Now, what? Who all else is playing at that one?
The big one for me that's on the bill for that is Motley Crue as well. They're joining them.
Nice.
Yeah. So you know, for those that like classic rock, that's two great bands right off.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So no, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, just going back to the script and what happened then when you'd finished the script.
Yes.
Obviously, you were relieved, is what the first thing. But then, what happened to the script then once you'd finished it?
Yeah, okay. So I sent it to the person that I expressly sort of wrote it for, James Melconian, who I'm not even sure if he knows. Like, I'm sure he knows by now. Like, he's the reason. Well, it's him with a combination of Pete Shint going, oh, yeah, Carl, I have the script ready. But him saying, oh, I'd really love to read it when you're finished with it. That was it. That was what internalized, you know, I had this director who wanted to read a script. I'm like, this is what I moved out to Hollywood for, you know, and I had been stumbling and bumbling around. I wrote a few things before Detroit Rock City, but like I said, I have a director who actually wants to read something that I wrote, which is, you know, that's like for a writer in Hollywood, that's a huge deal. You know, it's a huge step, you know. So I said, I got to take advantage of this. Anyway, okay, so I finished the script. And I send it off to him. And then he calls me. He read it right away. You know, I want to say over the course of a weekend. He goes, oh, I really liked it. I really enjoyed it a lot. I was like, oh, that's great. And he said, now, what does Kiss think of it? I said, I don't have any connection to Kiss. He goes, oh, you wrote it without a connection to Kiss? And I said, no, I didn't. He goes, oh, well, hey, you know, if you wind up getting it over to them, let me know what they think of it or something. He said something like that. I'm like, oh, my God. I can't believe I just exhausted so much energy. And I had this other idea. Like, it was about this guy who is a buddy cop comedy about this guy who got partnered with Elvis Presley back in the late 60s. It was called The King and Me, right? And I was like, I remember distinctly, I was like, I'm not writing another movie with a known entity unless I have a connection to it. I'm just not doing it. But it was really funny because, like, I was bummed out. But I kept, like, a copy of the script. And it sat in my drawer for, I don't know how long it sat in my drawer, for like 6 or 8 months. And then I wound up on this other movie, yet another movie, Barbed Wire, an editing room movie. Anybody, if you're thinking of writing a movie and you're listening to this, I strongly suggest working in an editing room. I really do, because like this stuff couldn't have happened unless I was an assistant editor, basically. And myself and this kid, this co-worker of mine, we were working on Barbed Wire. Which is a Pamela Anderson movie. Speaking of Motley Crue, you know, Tommy Lee's wife there, ex-wife. And it was an awful movie, as anybody who's seen it can probably attest to. But we kept doing these reshoots. And we had, like, these editors. We kept hiring editors. And they were, like, I want to say there were, like, 20 assistant editors, 16 to 20 assistant editors on this movie. And you'd think we were cutting Apocalypse Now. You know what I mean? That's how ridiculous it was. And I was working next to this kid. We'd have, like, our benches all set up next to one another. Editing benches are kind of like the editing room version of cubicles. You know, you're sitting at your bench and you're doing your work. And this kid, David Feldman, we I met him and we were talking about, you know, he went to NYU and he was like, he wanted to be a filmmaker, you know, and I was like, oh yeah, well, I had decided at that point, I was like, you know, I want to direct someday, but for now I want to like write something and then maybe I'll direct it. You know, like that was my ultimate goal. He was looking for something to direct. And I was like, oh, I wrote this script, Detroit Rock City. It's about these kids going to see a Kiss concert in 1978. He goes, oh, I got to show this to my buddy, Kevin Corrigan. You know, he's an indie film actor. And he says he wants to play Ace Frehley in the Ace Frehley story, basically. That was his, that's what he said. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. So I gave him a copy of the script. And little did I know, like, there was this whole, like, ricochet thing that happened with the script. Like, I'm just sitting at home, but apparently what happened was David sent the script to Kevin Corrigan, like, he hit the roof, he loves Kiss, you know. He sent it to his manager, who sent it to an old friend of hers who wanted to get into producing, and she was looking for a script to produce. And that friend was, when she got the script, she was sitting down to lunch with Barry Levine, who, you know, he used to photograph Kiss back in the 70s.
Yeah.
He was probably responsible. He was responsible for the Alive 2 tour book. I'm 99% sure. But anyway, she sat down with him and she's like, and they were exchanging stories. He's like, yeah, I was a rock concert photographer. I actually photographed Kiss a lot back in the 70s. She goes, Kiss? And she took this script out of her purse. She's like, look at the Detroit Rock City. And the guy goes, oh, this is hilarious. So he goes, and he was going to shoot Kiss when they put the makeup back on back in
96, wasn't it? Yeah, the 96. Reunion tour.
Yes, 96. Yep, that's right. In London. He took a plane from LA to London, and he took the script with him. He read the script on the plane, and, you know, he even said he was like laughing his ass off on the plane. He gets to London. Doc McGee is waiting there. So Barry goes, here, read this. He gets off the plane. Here, read this. You know, see if we can do something with this. So I got, like, they're just going to rewind back in time. I get that this kid, David Feldman, I kind of casually hand him the script. And then, like, 10 days later, it wasn't that Friday of that week, but it was the Friday of the next week, I get a call, and it's like, hey, Gene loves your script. Gene, this is how, like, fast it happened. Like, Gene, like, I was trying to keep track of all the people who had read it. I'm like, I know who Barry is, and I know who Lauren is, and I know who Molly is. Like, I was like, Gene, who's Gene? And the guy goes, Gene Simmons, you friggin' idiot. It was Barry. He's like, Gene Simmons, who do you think? I'm like, oh my God, Gene Simmons loves the script. And I did get a call from Gene a few days after that, and I saved it. I had the little cassette tape for a long time. It's like, hello, Carl. I just wanted to let you know I read the script and I enjoyed it a lot, and I'm looking forward to doing something with it. And, you know, it was like something like that. I was like, oh my God. And I had this little, and it got lost. It was,
it
got lost somewhere. We moved a couple of times and it was gone. But I mean, I had that, like, message from Gene Simmons. It was one of those things, one of those moments. It was just like one of those moments. It was a screenplay writer's moment, was what it was. And to have that, and a Kiss fan, of course, you know, Kiss fan moment. Amazing how fast things happen. And so the script wound up, for a couple of years, it was bouncing around. People, you know, somebody optioned it, and then they let the option lapse. And what an option is, somebody rents the script, and then an independent producer rents a script with the deal that they're going to bring it to a studio and make it happen. And if they don't make it happen within a certain period, a pre-agreed period of time, like 6 months or a year or 2 years, then the script automatically goes back to the writer. The intellectual property belongs to the writer, but what the producer's renting the intellectual property in the hopes that they can get the movie made and the script sold. So that happened a lot with Detroit Rock City. And, you know, I got to say, I made a little bit of money off of it, even without it getting made at that point, which is pretty cool. It's sort of like the Hollywood writer's tale, though. You know, a lot of writers out there, they're still waiting for something to get made, but they've made a lot of money off of, you know, options.
Yeah.
Basically, anyway. So it was just sitting around, it was hanging around, it wasn't doing anything, and then Fox TV got a hold of it, and they wanted to do like this big chill thing with it. They wanted to take the original script and then fast forward it 20 years. So all these kids are grown up. Like they wanted to make it be like a trip down memory lane for these guys, and they're going to see Kiss on what was then their current tour. And the Psycho Circus thing. So I was like, yeah, you know, that's the thing you learn when you're in Hollywood for a little while. You sort of, you're like, all right, well, this is different than what I wanted it to be, but it's my first script. You know, Fox wants it, Fox TV, you know, like, okay, you know, we'll, you know, we can work with this. But what happened was there was a bunch of producers who all had different ideas, and they were all sort of like coming up with you know, all these different takes on the script, and none of them were talking to each other. And it was turning into a mess as far as I was concerned. And I think at the same time, somebody at the top got fired, and they decided to scrap the project altogether. But I guess it was the best thing that could have happened, because it generated, there was like, it generated some buzz about this script, you know, and then it wound up at New Line Cinema, and Tim Sullivan, who I'm sure you've spoken to him in your travels, haven't you?
I haven't, no, I would love to, though.
Oh, yeah, Tim Sullivan was one of the producers on Detroit Rock City, and he was a story development guy at the time. And he tells a story of how New Line Cinema had been looking for a project to do with Kiss. And Michael DeLuca was a huge Kiss fan. You know, he was the head of the studio at the time. And they were looking for something to do, and they had all these ideas. There was one about like a medieval Kiss, a medieval futuristic Kiss who were living in this post-apocalyptic world. And there were like tons and tons of these ideas, and they all like starred Kiss, but when Tim Sullivan looked at this script, he was just like, hey, wait a minute, we can do something like this where we can still have Kiss in the movie, but you know, Kiss is like, this is what Kiss is. Kiss is like the Holy Grail. They're the destination. You know what I mean? They're like the thing that happened with a lot of those scripts that they had going on was like, you know, you got too close to the legend. You know what I mean? And it I don't know. There was just something. There was something missing from that. You know. Yeah. And this way, in this script, Kiss remains legendary. They remain that like. Sort of gold. It's always just, you know, outside your reach. As far as like, you know, especially if you love going to see Kiss in concert and whatnot, they're, you know, they're celestial. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Epic.
Well, it was. I mean, at that time as well. You know, 1978. They were, you know, they were superheroes, weren't they? They weren't even human. You know, they were nobody really knew, because there wasn't the internet and the media wasn't like it is now. Nobody knew what they looked like, and like you said, there was that whole unobtainable thing about them that they were so different to every other band out there.
That was what all their other ideas removed, that mystery, that mystique from them. You know what I mean? And they didn't like that. They wanted to remain. They wanted to be like that. Yeah, they wanted to be the superheroes, you know, and so so Tim Sullivan strongly recommended Detroit Rock City to Michael DeLuca, and he read it, he loved it a lot. Everybody thought like, oh yeah, this is the thing that we should be doing, and it was amazing, because I got, it was another one of those things, like 1996 was a big year for Detroit Rock City, when it got to, into Barry Levine's hands. Then 2 years later, it got the fastest green light. It was green lighted in like 17 days, I think, which is absurd. Usually it takes years and years for scripts to get, green lighted. And this one, it took days. And the upside of that is that, you know, they didn't have time to mess around with the script and to rewrite it. I should tell you, there's one more amusing anecdote. In that time, when it was at Fox, in between the time it was at Fox and New Line, there was like a little dead space there. And Kiss was getting kind of, I don't know, antsy about, like, they weren't sure if they wanted to do it, or they were kind of like on the fence. And Barry Levine had this great idea. He said, I want you to write two scripts. He said, don't rewrite the script. He said, I just want you to do one thing in each script. Come up with one for Aerosmith instead of Kiss, and come up with one for a fictional band instead of Kiss. So I wrote two, and it wasn't really writing. I was just going in. I was very careful. Like, most of the story doesn't hinge on every single little detail about Kiss. You know, it's about these kids, too. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I rewrote one for Aerosmith, and it was really hilarious. Because I found out that, you know, trivia, Aerosmith trivia, Steve Tyler apparently lost his virginity in a confessional booth, apparently. That's a total coincidence there. I found that out after. I don't know. It might be an internet thing, though. So, but anyway, that was one. And then in the fictional... in the fictional band one, I came up with this band. I think I told you already, but they were going to be like a Yes type band or a Uriah Heep band, and they were called Uranus, you know. So Barry is like, he went back. You know, he's smart, he's shrewd. He's like, he went back to Kiss. He's like, yeah. If you guys aren't on board, that's all right. We're gonna. And he actually sent this one script, the Aerosmith one. He sent it to their manager, just to say, you know, hey. This isn't, you know, you guys need this too. You know what I mean? So it kind of cajoled them into signing on. They were still like, oh, we're not sure if we want to do this. And so he's like, yeah, I sent this over to Aerosmith's manager. They're like, how did you do that? It's about kids. They go, no, he rewrote it. It's about kids. The story still holds up pretty good. So it's like, I can pat myself on the back that the story was that solid that, you know, you could have... change the bands out. You don't search and replace, you know. It was a little bit of a rewrite, but it wasn't a huge rewrite. So yeah. I don't know, it was pretty amusing, though. It was like one of those like Hollywood things, you know, little like movie things that happen.
You must have been so pleased then, obviously, when, you know, the movie was greenlit. That must have been a good day for you.
Oh yeah, that's right. It was huge. I still kept waiting for, like, I was like, some, you know, that somebody pinch me sort of moment there, where you're not sure if this is really happening. And I had like this experience very early on. I had an experience that most writers, wait their entire careers for, which, I mean, the sole credit thing is something, you know, just me getting sole credit. And that's because they didn't have enough time to rewrite it, you know? And Adam Rifkin kept calling me up, and he was asking me, like, oh, do you have a scene where this happens? We want a scene where we have the band Mystery playing in the garage. Do you have a scene where that's happening? I go, oh, yeah, because I had... this was the draft that they were working with, had it was tightened up, so there wasn't as much in the front end. And Adam Rifkin called me up and goes, oh, do you have a scene where this is happening? And I the answer was always yes, I had something. So Detroit Rock City actually resembles more of like draft, like, say, if you know, the finished draft of Detroit Rock City was draft 3, it resembled more draft 2, so it's even more like what I had originally intended. You know, it was something that I worked on, like, in my little writing cave. It wasn't a hired gun project, Kiss didn't come to me and say, hey, we need a movie about us. You know, I did it on my own. This spec script, it was a labor of love that wound up paying off, you know, and that is like, you know, it's one of those experiences that, you know, that a lot of people are still waiting for back in, you know, Hollywood there. I'm a very lucky writer. I'll just put it that way. I'm just a lucky writer, blessed. You know, that's huge. It's huge. It's a huge experience, and I was very lucky to have it early on. You know, to have that happen. So
the movie's been greenlit, and then they start filming it. What was the first?
Yeah.
What I'd like to know is how early on did you know about the actors that were cast in the parts, and if they resembled the characters who you got in your mind's eye when you were creating these, and also what was your first experience on the set of the movie and subsequent appearances on the set of the movie too?
Oh yeah, these characters, it was really hilarious. Eddie Furlong as Hawk, I was like, that is pretty good. That was pretty good casting. When I saw Trip, for some reason I was thinking like the long hair, like Hawk would have long hair. I wasn't thinking Trip would, but that was like a little bit of a switch. But I got used to it. And then of course, I think Jam, that Sam Huntington, his face was just so perfect for that part. That was a slam dunk casting. Because like I was like, oh yeah, that's what he looks like. I remember saying that to myself, like when I saw a picture, I was like, that's what he looks like. He's got to look like that, you know. That's awesome. Lex was the only one that was completely different from my original incarnation. Like my vision of Lex was sort of like a scrawny kid with the acne and. You know, glasses and, I don't know, braces, you know what I mean? Like that kid from Freaks and Geeks, the tall, gawky kid, you know, like that's what I thought Lex looks like. But Giuseppe was, for him, like he sort of like, he got the internal deal down with that character. Like it was a brooding character. He was pissed off a lot most of the time, and he was scared of dogs. He was scared crapless of dogs. He was, and he got all that down. It was really cool. And, as far as my experience on the set, I went up to Toronto, and the very first thing was. If I'm remembering this correctly, the very first thing was this concert at Cobo Hall, which of course was in Toronto. So I mean, where was it? The name of this city is on the tip of my tongue. It's a little bit outside of Toronto, but I'll probably think of it after we're done. I'll probably think of it. But anyway, it was. Went to this arena, and they actually made me up. I was actually in the movie briefly, but I wound up on the cutting room floor. They gave me like these big, like sort of mutton chops. I looked like Neil Young, and they gave me like a '70s wardrobe, and I appeared in a scene with my buddy Pete Schenck, and we were just people in the audience cheering, and. That was really cool. That was really amazing. And to be on the set of something like that, and it was actually the members of Kiss, and there was Ace Frehley like on the stage. And I had already met them. I had met them at a photography session that Barry Levine had when he was shooting the tour book for when they got the makeup back on in '96. I remember I had I've gone to their studio and hung out with them very briefly, but it was really cool. Anyway, there was Kiss. Kiss was on the stage, and Ace Frehley was he had this guitar solo, and the guitar was supposed to smoke, you know, but the stagehands were having trouble getting the smoke to come out of the guitar, and it kept ruining the take after take. But the guitar wasn't smoking, and I just remember Ace Frehley, like, he's just going, I think this guitar is too young to smoke. You know? He's really random, like I started cracking up. And I don't know, like, that's a moment I remember. I remember them getting out the tongue cam. I remember that. That was really I don't know if they have any behind the scenes footage of that tongue cam, but that thing was just that thing was one of the coolest things ever. And makeup effects people and KND rather were responsible for making that, but it's pretty amazing.
It is with Adam Rifkin as well, though. In a lot of his films, he comes up with some sort of ingenious camera angles in a lot of the stuff he does.
Yeah, that was brilliant. That tongue cam thing was great. And I remember, like, Entertainment Weekly had, like, the best shot of 1999, best shot. And I believe the best camera angle or something. It won this award. Excuse me, for the best of 1999. It was pretty cool. It just showed the still. I was like, oh, nice. And then the next day we were at the Warp radio station, where they, you know, they're in the elevator and they beat one another up in the elevator. Seeing how they initially find out that the tickets are that they no longer have the tickets. Mm-hmm. And that was cool. It was a very heady experience. I kept getting, you know, people were like running around with microphones and cameras, and you know, I definitely felt like you know, I was kind of a celebrity on the set, I guess. You know, people running up to me asking me questions, and you know, it was a pretty heady experience. It was heady. Just looking around as a writer. Looking around and realizing, like, the stuff was in your head, and then you put it on a piece of paper, and now it's real. You know, there is something. It just amazing about, like, you almost feel like you're a wizard or something. You know, like the stuff just you know, I put it on the paper, and now it's happening. And it was a really, really cool experience. It was a great on-set experience. It wasn't a long one. It was, you know, it was a day, but you know, writers on movie sets are kind of like, you know, the only person I learned that the only two people you don't want to see on the set are the writer and the editor, because that means that there are problems. No, I'm just kidding around. it's a director's medium, and the fact that Adam Rifkin, you know, he's a friend of mine anyway, so it's all good. But it's really nice when a writer is welcomed on the set of the movie that he wrote. It's really awesome, and that was a great experience. The end of that day, they started shooting the scene with Father McNulty. And I got to meet Windsor, Canada. Windsor, that was the name of it. Okay, so that's where the concert was shot, in Windsor, Canada. All right. Anyway, all right. So back to Joe Flaherty was the guy who played Father McNulty, and me and my brothers used to watch Second City TV all the time when we were little kids. And I just remember chilling out with Joe Flaherty. You know, he was, we're just like, you know, he was having a cigarette. I remember that. He was like having a smoke break, and I was talking to him, and we had this really nice conversation, and I got to tell him. It's like one of these weird experiences where I got to tell this guy, I'm like, wow, you know, I grew up watching SCTV, and you know, Count Floyd and like all these characters. He played a character, he played a newscaster named Hugh Betcha. it was just great, like just chilling with Joe Flaherty was like one of those. It's just a moment. It's just like a fantasy moment. That's what it's all about. It's that's why you get into making movies. Not like that's the exclusive reason, but you get into making movies because like these experiences that can happen. You know, you're inviting the possibility for all these like really wonderful experiences to happen in your like everyday working life. You know, it's just you know, when it's good, it really is a dream job. It really, really is. So it was good. It was the Detroit on set experience of Detroit Rock City was pretty terrific.
Oh, excellent! And you just mentioned about character names there as well, and you snuck in a couple of character names that Kiss fans will pick up on. Obviously, in Detroit Rock City with Beth and Christine, which is always good. Obviously the Kiss fans that would watch it would maybe not pick up on that. But there's little things like that all the way through. That, you know, if you're the more of a Kiss fan you are, there's little things that you're going to pick up on more. About when they talk about, Kiss will never do a disco song, and all little things like that, isn't there?
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, we really tried to do something. You know, it was a movie about fans. It was a movie for the fans. You know, I was really grateful. Like, you know, at the beginning of the writing process, I had Pete Schenck there, who was like this huge Kiss fan, and then Adam Rifkin, who you know, got into Kiss a lot too, and he was there sort of like when I was writing the script. These are just such weird experiences, but you know, I was working on an Adam Rifkin. I think it was The Chase was the name of the Adam Rifkin movie that I was working on. When I was really like trying to, you know, put the pedal to the metal on finishing a draft of that, so I was picking his brain on things. You know what I mean? On 1978, and like I'm writing this script about kids going to see a Kiss concert, so like that was happening. And then at the end of the writing process, to have Tim Sullivan there, who he also, you know, peppered the script with a lot of great little things. And then, I mean, you know, everybody that they brought on board, the music supervisors, the production designers, the cinematographer, they all brought stuff to that movie too. That Smiley Mart, the inside of the Smiley Mart was just incredible, you know, with like the mood rings and the Hustler magazine and the, you know, these just like the Pet Rocks, you know, all this stuff was just sitting there. That stuff that wasn't in the script. A lot of it wasn't in the script. A lot of it was just like, you could tell like these guys really, and guys and girls, they wanted to make sure that this rang true. And to have as much atmosphere as possible, and and if you're a Kiss fan, then yes, you will enjoy a lot.
Oh yeah.
I did write the part with the kid in the Ace Frehley makeup, though. He really did have in my script. He did have Ace Frehley makeup on. So that was something that was in the script, but I mean, you know, there are other things where it's just, you know, these little tidbits, people walking around, you know, the crowd scene with people walking around and most of them being in the Kiss makeup and all. I mean, just to, you know, there are a lot of people who, you could tell they loved Kiss and they wanted to do all their, you know, they wanted to bring that to the table.
I think it's true of all Kiss fans as well, isn't it, that we love the detail. We want to find out as much detail as we can about the band, and then obviously when there's a film about them, you know, the more little details there are in there for the fans, the better.
Oh, yeah, totally, yeah. It's it was good to, you know, it sort of drew upon my own, sort of, I don't know, drawing upon my own experience and then just having all these other people around who, you know, that there's something about, you know, when you have Kiss in the script, there's a lot of opportunities to just have all these details in there that, you know, I'm trying to think if there was probably like a fire. I want to say there's like a firehouse reference. I'm trying to think of that when I was writing the script. Like, there's some scene that took place where they had like I was working Kiss titles into it. It got a little ridiculous, but I had to back away again. Anyway, yeah, it's good stuff. It really was. Yeah.
Can you tell me about your experience of the very first time that you watched the finished movie? You know, where was it and when was it and what was it like?
They had a screening of it at, where was it? Was it at New Line? I think it was at a theater, actually, on the Fox lot, ironically. And it was it wasn't a cast and crew screening. It was more of it was an industry screening. And I went and I saw it, and I just couldn't believe, like, it was to watch, you know, pages and pages of this dialogue that I'd written. And they wanted to get an R rating, so they did throw in a lot of F-bombs, shall we say. And there were little ad libs here and there, tweaks on lines, but overall, this was, you know, it was my script playing on the screen, and I was just sitting there. I was like, oh my god! I said, if anybody has any, like, if anybody has any issue with this movie, this is they can come back to me. I mean, the buck stops with me on this one, you know. I love the way Adam Rifkin shot it too. Like, I wouldn't have shot it that way. I think I probably would have shot it more like, planting the camera in one place and letting the characters run around. But I did love the way he had the camera swooping all over the place, and I mean, it was it actually added a third dimension to the movie, I thought. I mean, there was that, and I just had this big smile on my face the whole time. I was like, wow, this is my kind of movie, you know. This is the movie that this is like a movie that I always wanted to see, you know. And a tremendous amount of satisfaction and joy with the finished product. I really did not have I had no issues with how it turned out. It was definitely, you know, I was surprised at what, like, there are things that when you're writing you think they're going to be funny and they're not, and then there are other things that when you're writing, like, jokes worked better. There were some jokes that worked better than I thought they ever could, and then there were other jokes that were just like little chuckles here and there, and I was like, wow, I thought that was going to get a big laugh, but then there was something else that you know, would get a big laugh that I wasn't expecting it to. A lot of that's like, you know, I saw it a few times, and I noticed, of course, if you see a movie multiple times with an audience, the audience reacts differently to different things. You know, they'll laugh at some places in one screening, and then you go to the next one, and they're not laughing at those places. And then, you know, so a lot of it's like just, I guess, what's in the air, what the atmosphere is like. But it was tremendously rewarding experience seeing it finally on the screen, and you know, that's one of the reasons why you know, people like me want to get into making movies. It's not just like, hey, I can do that, you know, I can make that, I can do that, I you're watching a movie and like, I can do that. It's more like, you know what, there's something that I'm not seeing that I can do, you know what I mean? Or I can do this better than that, you know what I mean? Like, I could do this, but better.
Yeah.
You know, there's definitely, when you want to make a movie, you're feeling like there's a space, there's a void out there, and you've got just the thing for that void, that missing puzzle piece, whatever it is, and I felt like Detroit Rock City. That was it. That was my tile in the mosaic. It was that missing puzzle piece, you know, that I was able to put in there, you know. And yeah, so paid in full. We'll say, just, you know, that's what I'm paid in full.
I'm going to put you right on the spot now, Carl, as well, because speaking as a Kiss fan, we love our what-if situations. You know, what if the original four had stayed together? What if they'd never taken off the makeup? So I'm going to put a what-if to you, Carl. What if there was a Detroit Rock City 2 set now with the same characters, so we're in 2015. What would Lex, Trip, Hawk, and Jam be doing now? What would they think of Kiss now?
Oh my god, that is such a...
I'm sorry about that. I know I've put you right on the spot with that one.
is it a can of worms? I don't think so. It's just like, wow, my head just exploded there, because I'm going to tell you, I think that Jam would still be... Hang on. Give me a second here.
It's a tough one. Okay. I know this is a tough one.
All right. I think Jam would be the one that would, like, he'd be looking like, you know, because he's the most like me. He'd be looking like a Kiss was the one, you know, for me, Kiss was like that place in time. And yes, you know, that I'm not discounting everything they've done afterwards has been, you know, significant in terms of, like, you know, there's some really great songs they put together, but it was nothing like that original lineup with the original makeup. All right. Mm-hmm. I think Lex, would be, I think Lex and Trip would be they would have stuck with Kiss this whole time. Lex and Trip would be the guys that stuck with Kiss, and like, they would have been, you know, going through everything, going to the concerts, you know, going to every year, going to a Kiss concert, you know what I mean? Just like, they would have been right there, and they would have known, like, all the albums that Bruce Kulick played on. They would have known all the albums, you know what I mean, that Eric Singer played on. And then I think Hawk would be, like, totally disgusted. He'd be, like, he'd be just, like, totally, totally disgusted. And he would be the character that would get brought back in. You know what I mean? He would, you know what I'm saying? You know, like, because I'm thinking, like, if you're going to make a Detroit Rock City sequel, Kiss has to be in it, and Kiss has to be sort of the Holy Grail again, you know? But Hawk would be the one who'd be like, oh, those guys, they just want money. They just this, that, and the other thing, you know, the big sellouts. And, like, he's the one that they have to, like, pull back and, like, you know, they'd wind up getting back together again and seeing Kiss one more time as
this,
a quartet.
This could be it, couldn't it? But because Kiss fans always, you know, I think one thing, general consensus is what Kiss fans would like to see is the final ever concert of Kiss where the original four get back together and play. I mean, that would be the ideal setting for Detroit Rock City 2, where, you know, Lex, Trip, Hawk, and Jam, they've got to get to that concert. It's the last time they're ever going to see, and it's the original four again.
Yes, that's hilarious. That's great. That's good. All right, I like that. Let's do it. Let's get all the people on the phone here.
This is where it started.
And this is where it started. We got to get Kiss on. We got to get Kiss first. Then we'll start with the other stuff. I hope that happens again, and I think we touched upon this on the last conversation. But you know, I think that would be a nice thing to have happen, you know, and to sort of just like do that thing for the fans, you know.
Yeah, just to put a bookend on it, really, if nothing else.
Yeah, why not? That's a great idea for Detroit Rock City. I can already see like Lex and Trip having these conversations about, you know, like, because they would like different, I think they would like different incarnations of Kiss, even though they've been, you know, they've been the ones that I've been going to see them through the years consistently.
Yeah.
You know, and somebody does like, you know, Bruce Kulick, like, you know, just somebody does like Eric Carr, somebody likes, you know, just having the conversations going back and forth, and having them having like disagreements about that. 90s Kiss versus, well, it was early 90s Kiss, late 80s Kiss. I don't know. You know, like I can see those conversations.
Oh, yeah.
Start to bubble up. And, you know, Jam having the wife and kids. I think Jam would have a wife and kids. I don't know. Maybe divorced. Hawk is this, like, Sons of Anarchy guy. That's what, just to keep you, like, honest, like, and he'd be like a loner, you know what I mean? That would be pretty funny, actually. I think Hawk would be like this total outcast. He's like, you know what I mean? He's a rebel, the rebel to the end, you know? And yeah, the other guys, like I don't know. I think, ironically, I think Jam would be like the happily married one, but he married a woman who's just like his mom, you know? And then, you know, these other guys have their things going on, but maybe, you know, you could get into a whole bunch of, you know, like a Trip. He's, you know, he got this 20-year-old girlfriend. I don't know. It could just like go to town.
it sounds good already. I'm giving you 6 weeks to write it, Carl. There you go.
Yeah. Oh my God. You know, I feel so ashamed of myself. I wish I could remember the name of this song. Is it Shandy? Is that the name of it?
From Unmasked, yeah. Is that the one you're thinking of?
He could have a girlfriend named Shandy so he can keep naming girls after Kiss songs. That's a thing that happens in these movies. But anyway, yeah, that's good. It's good stuff. That's good stuff. Yeah. I like it.
That'll be all right. Well, I've got Adam Rifkin coming on the show next month, so that'll be the next stage. I'll push it to him too.
Oh, nice. That's awesome, man. That's great.
Well, before we finish this up, Carl, I want to make sure as well, is there anything out there you'd like to let the listeners know, you know, about yourself? What are you up to lately too, since we last recorded?
Oh yeah. You know, the biggest right now, the biggest one, and I guess we're just going to keep it consistent. The biggest news is that Detroit Rock City is out on Blu-ray. That's the biggest news. But yes, I'm working on some ideas for a 1-hour drama TV series. You know, I've got a couple of ideas and a couple of connections there, which you know, they would be sort of like, there's one series about the Civil War, which I want to do a 1-hour drama, you know, multi-season type thing, for like Netflix or Amazon, mm-hmm. you know, that type of thing. Try to get the next Breaking Bad going, you know what I mean? And then there's another one which is more of like sort of an epic, historical epic, like kind of like the Tudors or Game of Thrones, you know. But again, stuff that's all I can say about them right now. But that's what I'm dabbling in. Trying to get that going, because it seems like that's like the next, it's the next big thing, at least the next thing that I want to do.
Yeah,
you know, is something like that.
Well, it's always, you know, keep me updated, and then, you know, I can pass it on to the listeners, you know, through the website and social media and so on.
Oh, absolutely, I will.
And look, again, that sounds good. As always, all the details of where you, the listener, can find and follow Carl online will be in the podcast notes on our website too. Carl, once again, it's been an absolute pleasure. I've loved chatting to you. I've been looking forward to this Detroit Rock City chat. And yes. I did, for those that are listening and follow 60 Minutes With on Facebook and Twitter, I did tweet before we started recording. You were so kind. I mean, we talked about it in the episode one of this, when I talked to you, of how we met on the set of Hellraiser Hellworld. But after that, when you got home, you were so kind and you sent me a care package full of like old Kiss Detroit Rock City stuff. There's backstage passes and stickers, even Detroit Rock City lip balm. And I've still got, I keep everything still in that little, the package that you sent it in. And it's, yeah, it's my little holy grail of Detroit Rock City stuff. So it's good to thank you once again personally, Carl, because it's so, as you can see, what is it, 13 years afterwards, now I keep it all really safe and it's treasured.
Nice, nice. Well, thank you. It's nice to know that I figured I sent it to the right person, and you'll keep it safe and pristine. You know, that's awesome.
Oh yes, it's like a hand me down now to my son. It'll be passed through generations. You've got to keep this safe. It means a lot.
Wow, that's terrific, and it is. Said it before, I'll say it again. That's what this movie is about. It's about the fans. It was for the fans, and you know that's I'm so glad that I was able to bring something to at least one Kiss fan's life.
Oh no, I know many Kiss fans who talk very highly of Detroit Rock City and love the film. You know, it is a love letter to Kiss.
It is indeed, and yeah, that's it. You know, you take that. If we can pass something along, even if it's one thing, it's worth doing. It was well worth doing, and I couldn't be happier. So, good stuff.
Well, yeah, like I said, Colt, it's been again a pleasure chatting to you. I'm sure we'll chat again. And yeah, just keep me updated on everything you do, and I look forward to it, and every success with everything that you do as well.
All right, thank you, David. It's been a pleasure.
All right, thank you very much, Carl. I'll speak to you again now.
Take care.
Once again, it's the end of another show. Hopefully you all found out a few more nuggets of information and trivia about Detroit Rock City. I know I did, for one. And like I said during the conversation with Carl, all the ways that you can find and follow him online will be on our webpage. And what you have to do is just go to 60minuteswith.co.uk. That's a numerical 60, not alphabetical. On there is a contact us form in case you want to send us any type of email. That's fine. You can email us directly as well, contact@60minuteswith.co.uk. You can find us on Facebook, which is facebook.com/60minuteswith. And you can also follow us on Twitter, which is @60minuteswith. iTunes reviews are always kindly received and gratefully received, and do make a difference in trying to get some guests as well. So if you would care to take a few minutes and leave a review, you'll be helping the show to get some more guests too, which is always a good thing. So I'd like to take this opportunity to thank Carl for coming back on the show once again, and also to thank you, whoever you are, wherever you are, for listening. And please keep those subscriptions active, however you may subscribe to the show, because as I mentioned as well, one guest that I'm going to have next month is the director of Detroit Rock City, Adam Rifkin, and I'm looking forward to some more stories about the movie from him, as well as stuff like, I'm a big fan of Psycho Cop Returns that he directed as well. So there's going to be all sorts of stories from Adam. But between now and then, we've got another entertainment show. We've got a new format show coming, where myself and Tina do an episode-by-episode breakdown of my favourite American TV comedy, Married with Children. The first episode of that will be the next one that will be released after this. And, of course, I've got more interviews planned, so keep an eye on our social media when I'll be announcing who else I'm going to be chatting with. So, thank you for listening, and I'll be back very soon with another show.